The World Series of Comedy. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 205.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new episode of The Art of Bombing. Dan Bublitz Jr. here with you today. It is Tuesday, June 1st, 2021. I hope you all had a great Memorial Day weekend. I did. That's why this episode is coming out a little bit later than it normally would, because I decided to take Memorial Day off, and I didn't do anything but lay around and watch TV, and it was great. Today on the podcast, we have a special, very special episode, because we're taking an inside look into the World Series of Comedy, because my guest today is the president of the World Series of Comedy, Joe Lowers, and the vice president of the World Series of Comedy, Jason Rowland. And we talked about the World Series of Comedy and how, you know, kind of how it's ran and what it does. And it's very informational and informative. We talked a little bit, Joe had a lot of stories to tell about doing comedy and things like that. So there's some of the normal stuff you would get on the podcast, but a lot of it was mostly just talking about the World Series of Comedy and how it works, I guess you could say. Now, before we get into this episode, I do want to let everybody know that while I'm having them as guests on the podcast and they're talking about their festival, I in no way am advocating for their festival, and I don't mean that in a bad way, because it sounds like it. What I'm saying is, I don't advocate for any festival. I think every comic needs to do their own due diligence and do their own research on festivals before they submit to see whether or not a particular festival is right for them. And by doing that research, you know, you can ask other comedians that have been in the festivals, or you can, you know, ask the producers questions. You can, you know, look into, there's lots of things. In fact, I did a whole Between Bombs on researching festivals and things you should do before you even submit. So I want you to keep in mind, I'm not advocating for any particular festival. Do your own research before you apply to any festival. I will say this, I did go to the World Series of Comedy in 2020, you may remember, because I recorded a bunch of podcast episodes, and I had a good time. So if somebody asked me if I would recommend the World Series of Comedy, I would definitely say yes, because I had a good time. But still, do your research, that's all I'm saying, do your research. But before we get into this episode with the fellas from the World Series of Comedy, we need to take care of that housekeeping.
It's time for housekeeping.
All right, first up, hats. There's Art of Bombing hats. I said this last week, but I'm going to say it again. They're available on the website. They're $20 plus shipping. I'll ship them wherever you want, mostly just within the U.S. I don't think I want to ship them outside of the country just because that's way more expensive. But if you're outside of the country and you really want an Art of Bombing hat, message me. Maybe we can figure that out. But they're great. They're black and gold. They have the Art of Bombing logo on them, the cartoon logo that we just had made up. They're embroidered. They're stitched really well. It's a Port Authority hat, so it's a kind of a name brand hat. They're very high quality, and they're only $20, and they're available on the website, artofbombingpod.com. Of course, while you're there, you can go to the Submit a Bomb page and tell your story of a time that you bombed, or if you have another, if you've already been a guest on this podcast and you've had another story about bombing, you can put it on there. I might read it on the episode, or if you call the Bomb Squad hotline, I might play it on the episode. I might even include it in the in our monthly newsletter, which is running a little bit late this month as well. It's supposed to come out on the 1st, but it'll come out in the next couple of days. But you can, submit your bomb, and then maybe it will be in either the newsletter or, like I said, played on an episode of The Art of Bombing. And if you haven't done so already, you can, best way to help us is to give us a 5-star rating and a nice review on Apple Podcasts. That helps people find us when they're searching for podcasts. Puts us, you know, helps us defeat the algorithms so people will find out about the podcast. And then, of course, you know, I am going to be starting to run ads on here, and you can, you know, always go to Patreon to get the ad-free versions of the podcast. You can subscribe there, or you can support me by buying me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/debubcomedy. You can throw a tip my way if you like what I'm doing, but again, the most important way that you can help this podcast grow is if you rate and review and share the podcast with somebody you know. Tell your friends about it. Now, the last thing we're going to talk about before we get into this episode with the fellas from the World Series of Comedy is I am planning a big tour. It is called the On the Run Comedy Tour because it's Dan on the Run is the name of the comedy tour. Dan on the Run. And I got a big summer tour because it's building up to doing an album recording in St. Paul, Minnesota in my basement. And I got lots of dates coming up. They're available. You can see all my dates on danbublitz.com. If you know people in any of those areas or you're in the areas that I'm going to be, come to the show. It'd be great to meet. It would be fantastic to meet some Art of Bombing fans at some of the shows. Again, all the shows are on my website, danbublitz.com, under schedule. You can see lots of stuff. I'm going to be in Kansas. I'm going to be in Nebraska. I'm going to be in Montana, South Dakota, Iowa, all kinds of different places. So check that out. All right. I think that is enough of the business, of the housekeeping, if you will. So let's get into this conversation with Joe Lowers and Jason Roland. Enjoy. Oh, that's hilarious. We're all wearing World Series of Comedy shirts.
Yeah, I got
we didn't even
I got
we didn't even plan this.
No, I have work World Series shirts. I have nice World Series t-shirts.
You have button-up World Series t-shirts for stuff like
that. I have dress World Series t-shirts.
Polos, you name it, you got them.
Yeah, just they're all t-shirts, but just some are in better shape and some don't show my gut as much.
I like how your last name is not capitalized.
Oh, I forgot.
Joe Iron. I works.
How do I change it?
That's great.
I'm going to try to change it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you can change it afterwards. It's not a big deal. I don't use much of the video anyway. So
fair.
I just like to have it on there just in case. Just in case.
Yeah, I changed it. So.
Oh, there you go. Hey, look at that. Boom. Yeah. Got it. We're good to
Are
go.
We on Square before we get started?
What's that?
Is it swearing?
Yep. Right. Yep. I don't have any language restraints.
So I have a tendency to have to tell Jason to not swear that much.
A lot of people, it's funny because they'll swear and then they'll ask. So thank you for asking before.
That's usually my thing. One of the very first times I did radio years and years ago, I swore on regular radio.
Oh, whoops.
The F word. Everybody in the studio just looked, and I was like, that's probably a problem. Like, I was just a feature. I probably wasn't even supposed to be on the radio, but the headliner was cool and let me come. And,
The early days of radio were really harsh for stuff like that. That was right after they finished doing Telegram interviews.
Yeah. Yep.
Long time ago.
Yeah, I swore in a Morse code interview once.
Morse code, yeah. Yeah. Dash dash dot
the guys,
dot
you guys dash, like, dash, just fucking tap it.
Really, just had to put some effort into that.
Yeah, yeah. And tap it with capital letters. I don't know how you do that in Morse, but just do it.
It's 37 dashes and dots. You really got to be angry at someone to do that.
Go out of the way. Going out of the way to swear.
So like, you guys are. You really want to pay for I'm yelling? Yes, I want to pay for those letters.
Stop. Start again.
Yeah, stop.
I love it. So you guys are gearing up for the World Series of Comedy 2021.
Yeah, holy shit.
Yeah, somehow it's like right around the corner.
Yeah, somehow we made it through 2020.
Yeah, that's
another year.
That was incredible.
Would not stop. Like, yeah, we have to, like, are you going to cancel? You're going to cancel? And we're like, no.
And yeah, we ended up migrating 10 of our 12 events online. We created a brand new event style for the World Series of Comedy. We created these video contests that we've sort of kept, and we're now adapting into something that we call online showcases, which are just another opportunity for comedians to get a little bit more face time in front of decision makers and bookers and managers. But yeah, last year was a real, real challenge, as anyone in the comedy industry knows. Clubs weren't open. And online stuff was like really kind of, it was so kind of like poo-pooed upon within the industry. And then it had to be immediately adopted as the only option. And so you kind of went from like Zoom. No one knew what the word Zoom was, first of all.
No, nope, not really.
You kind of went from like these online shows that no one ever really wanted to do anything with. They were like lower on the pecking order than like an open mic at a bar on a Tuesday night while the hockey game was on or the baseball game or whatever, to like being the only thing that was available. And so the world of comedy adapted, and the World Series of Comedy adapted as well.
I'll be the first one of the first ones to say how bad and how much I hated the year, just like everyone else. But I really think some good things came out of it. As much as it affected us, I really feel like Jason just said, our online satellites, they're pretty cool. And they're really, once we get the word out and people understand what's happening with them more, I think they're going to grow pretty big. And because it's an opportunity, instead of you traveling to a city, which is still very cool, and that's what every comic wants to do, travel the city, be perform live. But you're being seen by that club and us, the World Series. But these online ones, you're being seen by four, right now it's four clubs guaranteed, but my hope is eventually to have six, seven, eight clubs watching these videos. So it's, when I started, you had to wait months and months. You send a VHS tape out, and you waited and hope that they watched it and hope that they hired you. And then once they said yes or no, then you sent out another one to another club and started all over again. And this, at least with these things, your video is getting watched by four clubs, four major clubs, East Coast, West Coast. And they're looking. And the people that I deal with, the clubs that I deal with, usually get involved because they know what this, the talent level that we bring, and they enjoy being part of it, and they want to help too. I mean, we love doing it. Jason and I do the festival because we really, really love helping comics. And as much as sometimes the comics get frustrated with the comedy clubs not responding to an email right away and things like that, they're busy working, trying to keep their business alive. But they want to help. And the guys that get involved with us want to be part of it. They enjoy it.
Yeah, which is good, because cool. It definitely does help. And I even saw, like, this year you guys have added another element with the online videos, through ZippyVote, doing the audience participation, and people are getting into some of the satellites through that way.
I don't know if we're going to be doing that anymore. I love the idea of it, and I want it to work, but we just did our first one for the Punchline, and there should have been over 100 and some comics that did it, and the number was very, very small for the amount of work that I put in. I hate to take it away for the ones that want to do it, but it's a lot of work to put these shows together, and I did them solely because I wanted to give the comics another chance to get in, and not enough. I'm getting emails today from a comic kind of yelling at me because he's like, when's the voting start? And I go, it started on Sunday
Saturday,
and ended on Sunday. He goes, well, I didn't even know to promote it. And I'm like, that's because you didn't read the 75 emails that I sent.
One of the real challenges that we face with this kind of stuff is anytime we introduce something new, it takes a little bit of time for, you know, the hundreds or thousands of comedians that are associated with our festival over the last decade to kind of come to grasps with what it is. And so one of the things that Joe and I do, and we make a point of doing at any of our live events, is we hold a pre-show meeting every single show. And that's the time where we kind of have like a bullet point script of what we want to go over. And that includes...
I've seen Dan just totally like zone out during those meetings.
And it also works as kind of like a Q&A. So it's a great opportunity for comedians to go like, hey, what were these, the audience choice round? What's that about? What do I need to do? Mm-hmm. So the biggest challenge that we face is that we had an audience choice round event before we had a live event. So we didn't have the opportunity to talk to anyone at the live event to let them know kind of what it's like. It's something like Joe said, it's a work in progress. It's adapting something new to the world of comedy. And almost every single choice that we make as a festival comes down to like two or three criteria. One, does this benefit comedians? Two, does this benefit the industry of comedy so that clubs and dedicated comedy venues will also participate? And three, is it something that would be like effective use of the time of the festival to make sure that we can promote it well and give the opportunities that we think are available to the comedians to them? So we're constantly adapting. Last year was like the year of adapting. Joe was that he's going to like register the domain, the World Series of Adapting to New Comedy Things.com.
Yeah, I got to get ahead on that. That's for sure. Yeah. It's funny too, because you that's one thing. And for comics listening, read the emails. Read emails.
Yeah, I know they're annoying, but we try to have a system. And I know most comics don't realize the system, but once a comic registers, we Jason manages our whole email system. But as soon as they register, within a day or so, Jason, usually the same day, Jason removes them from our large email folder of like just basic, hey, register now, 12 days to register. He takes them out of that folder, so you're not getting all that kind of stuff. So every email that you get after you register pertains to your registration, so it's something that you should do. What happens a lot of times is comics, Jason's making that face because I use the word pertain. Yeah. I know that's why you're doing it. You're like, oh, geez, that's a big word for Joe. The problem is sometimes comics, instead of looking at the website or sending us an email about the thing, they go back on the registration form to look at something. As soon as they go back on the registration form, if they don't complete the registration, which they're not going to do because they've already registered, we have an integration set up where it automatically puts them back into the folder to get all the stuff.
Oh, gotcha.
We take them out, they put themselves back in, and then they complain that they're getting too many emails. And then we're like, well, you're not even supposed to be in that folder. But there's just, it's almost impossible for us to totally keep track of that. So
yeah, sometimes out of frustration, someone might either unsubscribe or like filter our email address so that it goes to a promos folder that they don't always read or whatever. And then also if someone's really interested in the festival and like is a big champion for it, like you have been, they may forward an email to a friend in the comedy industry. And if that person clicks the unsubscribe thinking that they got it directly from us, it actually unsubscribes the original sender. So, so we try as much as we can to stay in communication with people, but at the level that they've opted in for. Our festival is fairly unique. We are geared mostly towards features. So that means that we're dealing with comedians who are experience range anywhere from like 6 to 9 months to 12 or 13 years, depending on what value they see in the festival. Some very experienced comedians will register for the festival because they know it's a way for them to now network with specific clubs that they may have been having trouble getting into. We've had Harvey's, Laugh Boston, the two House of Comedies in the States. And those are like high value clubs for a lot of comedians. So even someone who may have been working on the road, getting paid full time as a comedian for the last 6 or 7 years may register for our festival because they really want to work at Harvey's or they really want to work at the House of Comedy in Minnesota or something like that.
Yeah, so, I've known comics that have done that, that specifically they registered more to go to the Satellites because of that, in, you know, as opposed to they, you know, I mean, obviously if you get in, it's great, but they were less concerned with the main event and more concerned with satellites because of that.
That's great. We want to be used. We Jason and I laugh about it all the time, but we have a lot of things in the festival that if you look at it, there's loopholes that you could be like, oh, they must not have figured this out. Sometimes we know them, we just leave them. We don't care. Because if it helps the comic and they figure out a way around it or figure out, I just got off the phone right before this podcast with a comic who really wants to get into Boston, and that it's going to be a hard one to get into. And he, I don't know if he will or not. He's, you know, I just know who he is and stuff. But I told him, I said, why don't you pick one of the earlier satellites when you register? Pick Boston, but pick one of the earlier ones. I said, even if you don't want to come, just pick it, because that'll mean we watch your video sooner. If you get in, then you know you have a good video, and you can just tell me, I don't want to travel there. If you don't get in, then you have time to submit another video before Boston to kind of give yourself a second shot.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that something you guys allow, is for comics to update their videos throughout the year, or
just not a spot we like them to keep sending us video? No,
send a new video every time you do a new set, please.
Yeah. Every time you get an email from us,
you're not listening to what he just said.
Yeah.
That's all they're going to hear in this podcast. Dan's day.
The fact of the matter is that we actually allow people to change your video once. Five judges who independently watch the videos. They don't have access to each other's scores or notes. And what we do is we ask all those judges to take notes on every single submission and score it on a scale of 1 to 30, three separate 10-point criteria. One is for stage presence, one is for overall, one is for originality. And then we tabulate all of those scores and rank them. And then based on what event you've opted into, like say you opted into the Fort Wayne Comedy Club live satellite, then we'll rank everyone who registered for that particular event, choose our top 35 plus the audience choice rounds, or the top 40, depending on what we're doing for that event starting tomorrow, I guess. You're ranking the top 40 today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so that's how we determine who gets in. You get in based on your submission video. Now,
if you get selected, go ahead, Jason.
If you do get selected, your video is locked in for the rest of the year. If you don't get selected, we offer the opportunity for you to email us and ask for notes from those five submission judges. And then we found, this isn't required, but it's heavily suggested, we found that you're more likely to have a better and improved score if you take the time to review the notes that were sent to you, implement those changes, and then film a new set based on those changes or suggestions that the judges had.
Because you don't have to implement them, but I mean, it's just what we see. We always say, if you see the notes and you see something written two or three times from different judges, they didn't see each other's notes. So it's probably a problem that you might want to address.
Yeah. And that's something just to add to that. I think, you know, if you can get take the opportunity to get notes as a comedian, you really should look at those notes and maybe think about applying some of that, because, you know, it's people trying to help you, especially with the feedback. You know, I was working with a casting director or casting producer for America's Got Talent. Didn't get in there, but she kept giving me feedback and I changed up my stuff, and she did submit it, you know, because I did what she said and what she thought would work or whatever, and what she wanted to see. Huh?
Where did you meet her?
I actually met her at my festival, the Snow Jam Comedy Festival.
All right.
So, sorry, buddy.
That's all right. That is great. She's wonderful. She's so.
Yeah, but she goes to all kinds of
comedy and all in the festivals, and she just loves comedy. She cares. I don't know how she gets her job done with the time she takes to talk and give to these comics. I know that's
absolutely. Her job,
but when she came to our festival in St. Louis, was it St. Louis? Yeah. When she was there, she.
Belterra.
Yeah, she talked to the comics like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Which I was like, wow, this is so great. It's so nice.
There was
so many different. Skill set that she's looking for than what you're doing to get into a club or a festival. And most comics don't realize that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're looking for a specific thing. And that's the other thing with, you know, taking feedback. Like, it ain't going to hurt you to take that feedback, you know, do a video, submit it for that thing. And if you don't get that thing still, you don't have to stay doing it that way. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you can go back to whatever was comfortable or whatever, you know, but it's still worth
taking. If you're not trying to listen and learn and grow, then you should probably quit.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. And I did. I've been doing comedy for almost 11 years and I'm still open to getting feedback, you know, like I've done contests where the judges would give you feedback and I was like, yeah, send me these notes. I would like to see what they have to say. Cause you're not going to get better if you're not trying to get better.
Yeah. And sometimes you're shot. You're like, oh man, I thought they would love that. It's like, okay.
One of the things that I think gets lost a lot in comedy is that, the further along you get in experience, not only as a performer, but more so as like a club booker. I used to be the general manager of a club and book the club. Or
Nice flex.
You can see those guns you're showing.
Yeah, hopefully this isn't fully on video. But one of the things that experienced viewers of comedy are looking for, they're not looking for specific jokes. Like if you didn't get into a festival, it's not because of the joke you chose to tell or that specific joke, or it's more so you weren't able to convey your point of view on life, the important elements to you when you're on stage, and sort of your perspective on what you think is funny or weird in life. The more personal you can get with stuff, generally speaking, the stronger your material will be, the higher the level of engagement with the audience and the relatability, even if it's not a shared experience. Like we had a submission this year from a female Marine. Like I've never been female and I've never been a Marine, but she told stories in a way that I could relate to because she used analogies or she had strong joke writing and joke structure to get the point across where it's like, oh, I can see how that experience was important to you. So now as a viewer, it's important to me. So I think as a comedian evolves, they need to lose attachment to the actual jokes and start focusing a lot more of their attention on their persona and their style and the voice with which they tell the jokes. Like if you can craft a certain stage presence and then start just telling funny stories from your life from that perspective, you're going to end up having longevity. If you're in, you're 11 years in, you don't tell the jokes you told the first year or two that you did comedy. You're going to retire jokes.
He's like, hell no. Nah, I know that's.
Look back and I'm like, man, I wish I never wrote those. Yeah, I can't believe I thought that.
I'm like an old like set list or something. I'm like, please tell me I didn't say that on stage. And it's like performed on. And I'm like, oh, man, that's so bad. So terrible. And like kind of what Jason's saying, even if you're, I know there's some comics will be like, well, I don't want to be personal. I'm a one-liner guy. Even if you're that type of comic, the more you – eventually you still will show you in that type of comic, the way you deliver that one-liner. And they'll be a part of you being more of it. You hear comics – some I think this happens more with newer comics, but they'll be like, that guy stole my material. Well, if they're able to steal your material – then it's probably not that great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a lot of things that I do in my show or I see guys do, and when we're watching videos, we're like, there's no way someone could do that.
Right.
They could try it. They could do it, and maybe they'd get a laugh or get away with it in front of an audience, but a booker or industry, a festival, they're going, that's not him.
That authenticity is really important in comedy, so.
Well, that's a big word. I never would probably use that word. Like that. I don't know if that should be part of our festival. I'm if you take that out.
You can use misdirects. You can have like kind of a crafted premise so that the payoff will work. But it needs to be believable to the audience. Because the last thing you want an audience member to do is to be sitting in their seat wondering whether the last thing you just told was actually true instead of paying attention to the next thing you're saying. So there's some great comics who use a lot of misdirects, even in our festival. John Wynn uses misdirects a lot, but all of the jokes are based in truth and authenticity. Mm-hmm. So that the payoff works better because the misdirect is stronger because it comes from this point of truth. But if you just had someone who, if as you're watching their set, you're like, clearly that's not true. Like, you were never in a store doing that at that time. And Arnold Schwarzenegger never walked in and said this to you while you're in the produce section. You know, so you're going to be sitting in the audience going, that's not true. And meanwhile, the comic is on like two jokes later.
And you're and now you're trying to like figure out what's going on.
Yeah, there has to be truth to what you say. Even like Jason saying, like, even if it's a lie, it has to be believable. There's so many, like, and the thing is, though, a lot of comics like to start off with like off the wall, crazy, like lies in their show or something like that. And then the audience is like, I don't believe them. And they don't want to be tricked. My wife hates magic shows. Mm-hmm. She hates magic shows because she doesn't want to be tricked. And when an audience believe you as a comic, they're like, yeah, I like this guy. And then you start to tell them something and you lie to them. They're like, screw him. I don't want to hear anything else he has to say. So now they're shut off. And now you've got to work to get them back. Yeah. If you want to exaggerate and really go off the wall, that kind of happens as you start to become a really strong feature or headliner. Like there's time, even when I had my show in Vegas, if somebody showed up late to my show, a lot of times we wouldn't let them in. And I'm 10 or 15 minutes late because my show starts off pretty crazy. But by the end of the show, I'm just lying, like just stupid shit. And if you walk in late, you haven't bought into that. I always describe my show as a Die Hard movie. If you watch the first Die Hard movie and you see Bruce Willis go through the glass and he flies down three floors, stories or whatever, and lands on a pile of glass and he runs away, and you're into the movie. You've been watching from the beginning. So you're like, oh, yeah. If you start watching that movie right at that point, you go, he would have cut his feet. Like, you question everything at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get, as a comedian, you have to get the audience to believe you, to trust you, so you can fuck them over.
Yeah, I've always been a firm believer that you have to be, you have to build trust and likability at the beginning. And once you have that, your audience will probably follow you anywhere you go.
Right.
But you have to establish that right away.
Well, sometimes in these festivals or even a guest set, comics feel like they need to do all that in 5 minutes. And sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just have to do honest, nice material that does well and shows your character and shows who you are. So when you walk off, that audience remembers you above somebody else because they felt like you were a nice guy. You would be you're like my grandchild or whatever. Mm-hmm. It might be.
That ties into a really good point about submission videos, actually, because I think one of the real challenges that comedians have is they think that they can just take one of their 25-minute sets, cut out a 5-minute portion and send that in. And that's going to be their 5-minute submission video.
You can't do that.
You can, absolutely. You can. It's very much because one of the real challenges with comedy is in order to earn the 25 minutes that you would get as a feature or the 45 minutes you get as a headliner, you have to develop a completely separate skill for showcasing. So that's probably putting together your best 5 minutes, which means editing down jokes, combining jokes, figuring out a way to make them make sense together, and practicing it, rehearsing it well, getting it filmed well, and then submitting it on the hopes that it's going to be watched and either gets you a guest spot at that venue where you can maybe do 7 or 12 minutes or gets you booked, which gives you the freedom to unpack those jokes in sort of their full glory and their long form. But learning how to create very specific showcase sets that you can film and send out to bookers and festivals is a skill that is underrepresented in comedy because comedians just think, oh, I had a really good set that night. I'll just send 5 minutes from that set. Well, that 5-minute bit from a longer 25-minute set is not your best 5 minutes. And then also, if you do get into a festival, check with them to see what the rules are. If you're able to repeat the same material, do it because bookers want to see you perform as well in front of different crowds with the same material. So don't feel as if you get into a festival, you have to do this 5 minutes in show one and this 5 minutes in show two, unless it's required as part of the rules. Because just speaking plain math, if you give me 2 different 5-minute sets, one of those two is not your best 5 minutes. You're giving me minutes 6 through 10. So the challenge as a comedian is the goal is to have as much time on stage as possible. But the only way to reach that goal is to figure out how to boil down the essence of you as a comedian in 5 minutes, film it really well, send it out, and try and get work that way.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's an elevator pitch. Yeah, it's your showcase.
Right before this podcast, I told him, I said, he's like, how long is the video that we submit? I said, 5 minutes. And he's like, that's all? And I go, well, you can send one as long as you want. We're watching 5 minutes, the first 5 minutes. So make sure there's not a lot of bullshit up front and you walk into the stage and theatrics and all kind of shit. Start the video with you talking and don't have anybody else in the video. We got a video. I probably have said this 100 times, and Jason knows the story. We got a video from somebody. I think it was last year or the year, a couple years ago, whatever. Somebody submitted it. The video starts off with the guy on stage saying some of the most terrible things you could ever say to a woman, calling her like everything that's just bad, screaming at her. And I'm like, holy shit, what is it? And then the guy goes, all right, let me bring up your first comic.
Oh my God.
He wasn't the one we were supposed to watch. Now we know that because we continued watching, because that's what we do in this festival. If he sends that video out to a club, he's going to be like, man, none of them are hiring me. Yeah, because they all think they think you're the asshole. They think you're the one who's that's. So just take some time and think about your video. This whole contest, our whole festival, you get selected from your video.
Yeah, well, and that's most festivals. I mean, there's very few festivals that hold live showcases. I mean, there are a few. I know Just for Laughs is one of them that does that, where they do, you know, live showcases. But there's not very many festivals like that. It's all, most of them are based just on that submission, that video.
And then there's so many guys in Redstone that don't, even ones, comics that we've gotten to know throughout the years, because this festival's set up in such a way that the judging is so, like, I'm really nuts about the rules. And so it's set up in such a way that we can become friends with the comics and stuff. So we have tons and tons of friends that register for this festival that we know. And then they'll be like, how come I didn't get in? And we're like, because she submitted a shitty video. And they're like, well, you know I could do good. And I go, I'm not the one that picks. I'm not even watching the videos right now for the satellites, because I have four other guys doing it. I trust their opinion, and I've been doing it for 12 years. Jason's been doing it for many, many years. I want to try to change up who's picking and what, and Jason and I both watch all the scores, monitor all the scores, talk to the judges, make sure they're not getting out of hand or something like that, and we monitor everything, but just because I know you doesn't mean I can get you into my festival.
Yeah, absolutely. We're
such sticklers for the rules. There was at Belterre at the main event, we had a score come through and it was like, this score doesn't make sense. And at that particular venue, our office was behind a theater stage and the judges were at the back of the room of the theater.
So
we only have a couple minutes to tabulate all the scores and determine who the winners are going to be, because we're rolling through three shows a night to get through the main event. And so Joe and I are like, trucking our way towards the judges section, we grab this one judge, like, we have to talk now.
Take him out. The bathroom, remember?
What's that?
He had went to the bathroom and we had to wait for him to the bathroom.
That's right. And so then he comes out of the bathroom. We're like, did you mean to give this person 9? Because everyone else scored them really high. And so, like, 9 out of 30. And he goes, no, it was supposed to be 9 for each category. And we're like, well, that's a very big difference that you're adding 18 points to someone's score.
Yeah.
And so, so, like, we could have taken the easy route and just, like, either eliminated his score or counted his score and just passed through. But it actually determined who was going to advance. And that year, we had the closest outcome for a semifinal show we've ever had in the history of the festival. We had Trix, James Schrader, and Paul Conyers all on the same semifinal show. And with a panel of 17 judges, they came within a point and a half of each other.
Wow.
And so
I'm surprised, because I didn't think James Schrader was that good. I'm just kidding.
That's lifestyle.
If he listens to this,
I know you know him. I was surprised.
I love James.
I know James too. I was surprised. When you're dancing around like a silly goofball and showing how pretty your hair is.
Yeah. James, you really should quit comedy and sell soap full time.
Yeah.
Well, that's he does a good job at that too.
Oh my god. Super Bowl. Every time you see him on there, you're like, oh, why? Like, you're watching YouTube videos and it gets cut in with a commercial came in it. And I'm like, I'm so happy for him, but I don't give a shit.
I was sitting on my couch one day and my fiance was watching something on YouTube and all of a sudden I heard his voice and I'm like, what? What is this?
Yeah.
Well, he does a
great job.
I texted Joe during the Super Bowl. I'm like, James Schrader was just on the Super Bowl. And he's like, what? And so yeah, he's on this commercial. So now we're trying to get them as a sponsor for the festival.
we
the Super Bowl or the soap?
Yeah.
Both.
I see comics all the time that have done the festival doing a commercial or something like that. I was watching what's that show? I can't think of
the Snowfall?
Yeah, Snowfall.
Yeah.
And I'm in season 3. And Snowfall is about the crack epidemic. And
I just started watching that.
Oh, it's so good. So, like, I'm in season 3. And they do a flashback. And this guy walks into a room and kills another guy. Well, the guy looks up smiling real big. And I go, man, I've seen that guy in something else. And I go, oh, shit, that's Willie Mack. I don't know Willie.
Yep.
Yeah, so I text Willie and I go, hey, dude, did you just get killed in season 3, episode 8 or whatever of Snowfall? And he's like, yeah, man. And I go, you died great.
Like, that's great. Yeah, it's funny, too, because he was in a couple Super Bowl commercials, too. Not just last year, but like the year before. He was like two of them.
Yeah, so talented.
Kia commercial or something, like some – he was having a water fight with his girlfriend in some commercial or something.
He's so talented and so ridiculously nice.
Super. Like, and he just got his own show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's great.
One of the big elements of the festival is that we try and either through osmosis or actually telling people, try and help people work on their professionalism within the industry. That starts with the type of video submission you're going to send. It continues on with the style of communication you have with bookers and venues. But Willie Mack had like one of the best bad moments of the festival. He handled himself so great. So he misunderstood which show he was going to be on for the semifinals at the House of Comedy in Phoenix.
Oh, man.
He advanced, I think, from the Thursday show to the Friday early show. He misunderstood and he thought he was on the Friday late show. He had to go back to LA to film something during the day. And then he was coming back on Friday and I'm texting him furiously. Like, we do these pre-show meetings 30 minutes before showtime, partly to make sure everyone's there. He's not there. I'm texting him. Are you on your way? All this kind of stuff. He goes, oh dude, I legitimately thought I was on the late show. And he sent an email apology to both Joe and I, in addition to texting us. And then he called Joe, I think, the next day, knowing that we'd be busy that night, and just apologized for messing it up, took complete ownership of it. Whereas like a lot of comics in the industry would be like, oh, can't you just put me on the late show? You know? Mm-hmm. And so he just handled it with like such class that it really ratcheted up our opinions of him, you know, like, he made a mistake, but he owned it so well that if we were a club, it probably wouldn't have affected our relationship with him. And as a festival,
happens. If you don't handle it properly, there's clubs that won't have you back.
Plus, clubs talk to each other. If you screw up at some club in the middle of Kansas, there's a strong chance that everyone in St. Louis and Chicago and anyone in Minnesota or Wisconsin is going to hear about it somehow through the grapevine. And then this business, for the most part, weeds out the assholes. You tend to not last in comedy if you're a real dick and hard to work with, just because pure
demand.
Well, you had to start a festival to keep working.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, but you had to start your own festival. Jason beat me to it.
Yeah, you could go for help. That's bullshit.
You would hang up if you could figure out StreamYard.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, there's been so many people that have come to our festival and they're like, man, the camaraderie of hanging out and being around everybody, that's really what's cool about this festival. And I think we really kind of push that.
Yeah.
Not meaning to, it's just that's how we are. And mm-hmm. and if somebody, there's been many comics that have come and gone and they don't want to be part of our festival because there's too many rules, or they don't like festivals, or they didn't get what they thought they should. And that's fine. Festivals aren't for everybody. Contests are a pain in the ass. But this is designed to help comics and make them understand what the clubs are looking for. And if you get it and come in and try to help each other, like if you come to our festival and you're being a dick and not trying to be nice, it's not even Jason and I going to be rough on you. Everyone, there's 100 and some comics at that main event. If you're an asshole, you're going to get pushed out.
Yeah, no, I can totally see that. That's actually, and that, I think that's really important with festivals, and it's really can be hard to do with contests. So that's really good that you push that with the camaraderie, because, you know, I helped start the San Diego Comedy Festival, which was a contest, and it was a great festival. I love it. Don't get me wrong in there. But one thing I noticed is it seemed like unless people knew each other already from their comedy scenes, or they like worked with each other because it was a competition, there wasn't as much camaraderie, because they weren't like, you know, they saw each other as competition, really? You know?
Yeah.
And so they didn't want to hang out outside of the shows because, you know, to them it was competition. And so when I started my other festival in South Dakota, that's why I didn't do a contest. I was like, I don't want that. I want comics to come network and have a good time and, you know, and just have fun, because that's what a festival should be.
And I agree. That's, we put work really hard and talk about it quite often, about the contest is just an element of this festival that gets the bookers to come and a way for us to find a winner. It's, if a comic got a hold of me and said, you know, I'm registering solely because I don't want to win this contest, I probably would tell them to keep their money. It's just because that's not why you should register. I understand, most guys really are competition. I mean, Jason and I are always placing bets and pushing each other with stuff like that. And that's how guys want to win. So if you register for something, of course you want to win. But the ones that get the most out of this go, okay, I didn't win tonight, but that's cool. I got to meet this person and I get to go here. And that's
what we're doing afterwards too. Like, we go out for dinner every night after the show. And Joe and I talk about this a lot. That's probably the most valuable element of the festival. It sounds stupid, but it's, you get to sit around in a very casual environment and just talk shop with
like
people who are willing to be open and honest and provide constructive feedback. And be like, yeah, you had a great set tonight. You didn't advance, but that's not because you're bad. It's because three other people were slightly better tonight. You know, came on stage and you overhyped the people who were on before you. Like, give it up for her and make some noise for her. And you're doing all these kind of like open mic habits. If you eliminated those, focus more on material, then you'd have more to showcase people during that 5 minutes. We had in Chicago. There's this couple that registered for the festival, Drew and Aurora Schaefer. And Drew had a very strong set, but he said the word guys 17 times in 4.5 minutes. It got so distracting that I started tally marks. And one of the cool things that we do with the festival is everyone gets a copy of their video, of their performance on video after the shows. When he got his video about 3 weeks later, he was like, oh my God, I did. And he created a YouTube video where he did like a little ringtone every time he said guys. And he was in the corner like commenting on his own performance, saying like how distracting it was to say guys. He is 4.5 years in. He didn't even realize it. So
he went out with us to eat. Yeah. And then we told him this, and then he got advanced and took it out in 3 days.
Or 2 days. So it was a habit of his for 4.5 years, and he eliminated in 2 days. And mm-hmm. his second performance was 7 minutes long, and he only said it 3 times, and one of those 3 was in proper context. And so it's just comedians aren't really aware of elements of their performance that might be triggers or red flags to bookers.
Ticks.
Yeah. So having the feedback, like mind hiving your performance, can be really beneficial to some people. And we do post event surveys with our participants. And at the main event for the last 3 years, the contest has ranked 5th or 6th on the list of what did you value from the experience during the main event or during our satellites. And it's almost invariably number one is the networking with fellow comics, then the networking with industry, then the feedback from the judges. Then it's like developing contacts and potentially getting paid work. We do a specific meet and greet at the main event. And so one of the cool things that Joe and I see all the time on Facebook is like Ray Hensley and Ira Summer doing a show together somewhere. And it's like, we know those people didn't know each other before.
Even more, I like it when they bust each other's balls.
Yeah.
If somebody posts something in another state, another comic, and another one says something smart, and I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. They didn't even know each other.
Yeah, that's one thing I really like to see it with our festival, too. The same thing I've seen that where comics that didn't know each other are now grown into being really good friends, even though they don't live like in the same areas. But and to kind of, I can attest too to what you guys are saying, because I was just at the main event last year.
Yeah, you were.
And going with that, I didn't care about the contest, and I actually felt like that helped me because I ended up advancing because I didn't feel pressure. Like I wasn't putting pressure on myself to try to win. I just was like, oh, this is here. So cool. I get some stage time, but this is why I'm coming, which was to go meet other comics, meet the industry, go to the panels and the workshops and my podcast. I was like, these are all things that I can accomplish. The contest is just a small element. No pressure, ended up doing pretty good. And so, yeah, so I can totally attest to what you guys are saying there, that if you
think you've done a good job of marketing yourself, like you've come up with a brand and you have like stickers and business cards that underscored that brand. And not a lot of comedians put that extra legwork into it. A lot of comedians are like, here's my material stands for itself. And choose to book me. Well, the challenge with that is if you go to any club or any dedicated comedy venue and ask the booker how many people are asking for stage time versus how much stage time they have, plus also how much time in their week they have to dedicate towards booking people, mm-hmm. the chances your video gets seen is very, very small in the real world setting. So that's what's cool about festivals like the one we run, and I presume like the one you run, is that we promise that we're going to watch your video and you're going to get constructive feedback on it. And then that can help separate you maybe from the rest of the crowd. Like I tell the story a lot. My last week working at the club, I had an email inbox folder that was dedicated to people who were looking for work. And there was 1,100 comedians in there. And we had maybe 40 spots a year that we were booking outside of returning comics and having to fill in with locals and keeping developing middles and features from our own local scene. So, you know, like 40 out of 1,100, that's like what, 3%? So 97%.
Probably not even. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, you're going to get like a no
based
on math. Nothing to do with your ability. So then now you have to go like, okay, I'm facing a 97% uphill battle. What do I do to separate myself from the rest of the crowd? Make yourself really easy to work with. Showcase your actual writing and performing ability in the video that you submit, and then just communicate with someone in the way that they would like to be. If someone sent me what was obviously a huge bulk CC email to every club in North America, like you're pretty much going to the bottom of the list. But if you take the time to find out my name, what day we have showcases, ask if you can do a showcase in person. There's a lot of ways that you can work within the system that makes it very obvious that you're the type of comic that someone wants to work with. So it's much easier to rebook someone that was easy to work with, got you the paperwork back easily when you signed a contract, all that kind of stuff. There's all these little things that may not directly relate to the material you tell on stage can help you get booked.
And these are all things that you can learn by if you go to the main event, because a lot of the workshops and the Q&As, this is a lot of the information that was covered, you know, at least at the ones that I attended. A lot of everything that you're saying here was said, not just by you guys, but by people from those clubs that were, you know, the industry people that came to the festival to judge.
And what's cool about that is that you see that those club owners and club bookers are genuinely concerned that comedians have all the information available to them so that they can succeed. Because the club isn't going to be popular if it doesn't have good comedians performing at it. So there's a symbiotic relationship between comedy clubs and also the comedians. But one of the things that we need to do is to make sure that the comedians work hard to earn the right to be on those stages. And so...
take everything personal.
Yeah.
He didn't email me back. Must not want me. Think about the business. And I know it's hard for some guys. Some comics don't have the business sense. But think about the day in the life of a booker in one of these clubs you want to work at. Think about how much shit, when you got up today... what was your plan for that day and what got in the way of that plan and what fucked up your whole day? The little things.
Yep.
You know? So now think about somebody who owns a business and maybe their day was going to be, I'm just going to answer emails that I've been getting from these comics. And then the freezer went out and the server said they're not coming in and a pandemic happened. Like shit goes on in the business and you just have to look like it's not about you. So make, like Jason said, just make yourself easy to book. Make yourself fun. Don't be a pain in the ass, but do what they say. If they say, send me your bells every week, then do it.
Well, and I think it's important, too, to remember, you know, not every club has a dedicated booker. Like you said, a lot of times the booker is the manager, is the owner, is the chef's assistant, is the runner of food. You know, like they wear so many hats.
Yeah. Correct. And that kind of goes to another thing is when you show up at a club, be respectful and nice.
Stay out of the way.
Stay out of the way and be respectful and nice to everyone because you don't know who is going to get bumped up to be the booker the next time.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter,
that's very true.
Who's the server that you're hitting on and trying to sleep with is the daughter of the owner.
Yeah.
See, everything we talk about in the festival, and I try to help people, are mistakes that I've made or people made and people have done, I've seen. I've watched somebody come in and get smart with a female server. And I'm like, what are you doing? And that server is the owner's daughter. And the owner's daughter and the owner had talked to me about how he is really hoping in the next year or so the daughter takes over everything so he can retire. Who do you think she's going to remember? That guy that was kind of smart with her? Or there's some comics in the festival that my wife does not like. That have done it in the because they were very rude to her when she used to work the ticket counter at the main event because they didn't know it was my wife. So she told them it cost $5 to get in and they gave her a bunch of shit about it. And then we drove home and guess who heard about it? How stupid is that?
Yeah, if you ever worked at Laughs Unlimited in Sacramento, everyone in that club is related personally somehow to Jenny, the owner. Like the bartender is the father of her child. Her mom is the person who answers the phone for the reservations. She, every single one of her servers has worked there for at least 7 or 8 years. She was the accountant of the club before she bought ownership. So she has like the staff mentality, like the worker, hourly worker mentality that she takes toward ownership. If the
bartender, then he will take the bottle of pop that you had asked him to keep cold and shake it up before he gives it to you. He said that to me right in front of me. I'm like, you motherfucker.
That's funny.
But also
I remember her actually because she was at the main event and did some of the panels and she told a story about that too, about how a comic was basically talking crap to the I don't know, remember who it was particularly, but it was somebody that was related to her. And that was the point. Yeah. It was like, be careful.
It does. Sometimes they don't have to be related. Jen is an incredible owner. And it, yeah. she's loved by everybody. If you talk shit about her or the club to one of her staff, they're loyal.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, McCurdy's, when we show up at McCurdy's Comedy Club, that's such an incredible club. It's ran so well. It's they the staff is so great. And if you shit on one of the staff, you're shitting on everybody. Yeah. It's going to get bad.
Well, the other thing too in comedy, like, and as comedians get more experience, they realize this, but the staff members, like the serving staff and the bartending staff, are heavily involved in the feedback process with the booker of, did the audience seem to like this person? Because they're the one who has FaceTime with the audience at all times. Sometimes the booker is out front dealing with a customer complaint, doesn't get a chance to see your showcase or doesn't get a chance to see your full set, or only sees you the Friday early show and not the other four shows you've been booked on just because they're busy doing other stuff. But if you can impress the staff, and bookers will often go to the staff and like, should we have that person back? And so now you're dealing with not only your ability to perform as a comedian and impress the crowd, but now you're like, what's this person like to deal with? Did they pay their bar tab? You know, like, did they try and
save money? Did the comic make the audience happy where they tipped them?
Yeah.
Like, if a comic pisses the audience off and then they're not tipping, that's the first thing the servers are going to be like, oh, I didn't make any money with this guy. I don't give a shit how funny he is. I don't want him here. I want
to
make me money.
Yep, that's a good point. Now, we are kind of approaching an hour, and we could talk about festivals and we could talk about what to do and what not to do in comedy, which this has all been great information. But we can't end the podcast, The Art of Bombing, without talking about bombing. So we got to hear a couple stories before we get out of here. We've got to do this. So we'll go ahead and I'll just start with you, Joe. Why don't you tell a story about a time where you felt like you bombed really bad?
I said to my wife, I said, man, I'm going to get on this podcast in a minute here. And I go, I think bombing is kind of like having a baby. Like, you forget the pain. Like, the longer I've been doing, I'm like, I didn't have any bad shows. And she goes, so then my wife goes, you mean the time that they, the audience got into a fight in front of you, that wasn't a bad one? And I went, no. And then she goes, you mean the time when you got punched after a show? That wasn't? And I go, no. here's one. One that I think's really interesting was I did a show in Elko, Nevada, and it was a Friday and Saturday. Shuley Agar from Howard Stern, before he had gotten on to Howard Stern, was a good friend of mine, still is a good friend of mine, but he was opening up for me. So we do the show on Friday, and we're sitting in a restaurant on Saturday, and a server walks by that we had seen from the restaurant that was working the club the night before. And I said, hey, how are you? And she's like, oh, I'm not too good. And I go, oh, what's up? And she goes, one of our regulars died last night after the show. And I was like, oh, man, that's a shame. And she goes, yeah, the FBI's in town investigating. And I'm like, oh, shit, he didn't just die, you know? So she's like, we're having a candlelight vigil in the club tonight during the shows, and then walks away.
Oh my god.
And the other comic look at me and they're like, what do we do? And I go, how the fuck do I know what to do? So this club set up like kind of, I don't know how, like there's a bar here, there's 100 people in front, directly in front of the stage, that have no clue about that guy dying. Off to the right, stage right, there's about 25 people with candles crying and weeping. So I'm standing in the back of the room, and I told Shirley, I said, just ignore them and just kind of do your stuff. Do what you can. So Shirley does his show, and it's going pretty good. And right near the end of the set, I'm standing with the manager, a guy walks up and says, before the headliner goes up, I would like to go up and make an announcement. And I go, hey, man. I go, I'm the headliner. And I go, that's really going to be hard to follow. I said, I know what happened, and I'll make an announcement at the end of my show and bring you up, and you can say whatever you want. and he storms off. And I turn to the manager and I go, "This is going to be a problem. You're going to need to get security here and make sure they're ready." And I hit the stage, and within 2 minutes, maybe, they're throwing shit at me and yelling at me and threatening to kill me. And I had somehow gotten the audience, the main people that like me in that short amount of time. So then I just go, "It's me or them. Which one do you want?" And they're all like, "We want to see your show." And I'm like, "Get the fuck out. Go mourn somewhere else. Go burn your candles." And I just ripped them apart, and then security had to come in, and it was pretty interesting. So that was a rough one.
Oh, it sounds like it.
I have it on VHS, so it's pretty crazy. Sure. Yeah. I threw an audience out. I had a – mine are a lot of fights. In my show in Vegas, I threw an entire audience out before the show even started.
Oh, gee. Why? Like, what happened? That's interesting.
I was in the backstage. I never like to talk or be seen by the audience before I go out, because I want to come out. I'm silly and goofy and off the wall. And so I try not to. And my wife texted me and said, "They're moving." We only had about 15 people. And our role was, you sit where we sit you, you know, right up front. And if you don't want to sit up front, then you don't come to the show. Because that's how I only want to do the show if it's packed and it's a nice show. So they start to move. She went in and asked them to stay in their seats. And then I just went out and I said, I went out and I said, "Hey, this is a Vegas show. You don't get to choose your seats. These are the seats that we have. Please sit in them." And the woman's like, "Why don't you buy me a drink?" Like, "I'm not going to buy you a drink. I just need you to sit out." She goes, "I'll sit wherever I want." And I turn to my sound guy and I go, "Turn the music off. This show's over. Everybody get the fuck out of my showroom." And I turn to the other people and I go, "Blame this bitch right here."
Ouch.
And my host walked out and said, "He's not kidding." Everyone leave.
This is not part of the show.
I'm like, I go, "I have to get up and do an hour in front of you, and I hate you."
No, I don't know about that, Joe. I think maybe there's a 10 o'clock tournament at Caesar's Palace you might have wanted to get to.
Yeah.
I went to Joe's show one time, and he goes, "If you and Mark come in," this buddy I was traveling with for poker, "if you and Mark come in, then the venue says we have to do the show. If you and Mark don't come in, I can go play poker. Do you want to come see the show?" And we're like, "I can see you anytime, bud." So we went. We played the 10 p.m. tournament at Caesar's Palace that night.
That's funny.
I flew to Hong Kong once to do two shows. And the first show, it just goes to shit. My show's very interactive, and I talk to the crowd a lot and a lot of improv and stuff. And it just goes to shit. And I was already kind of nervous anyways, because I'm like, I don't know if, you know, what they're going to want to see in Hong Kong. And it was in an Italian restaurant with mostly Americans, Australians, Canadians, stuff. So they understood everything. And I'm like, "Hey, how are you? Where are you from?" Or whatever. I'm starting my show. Nothing. And I'm like, "Oh, man." Like, it was just so tight. And I just ate a bag of dicks. And then I'm just like really depressed. I'm like, I just flew whatever it was, I don't know, 20 hours to just suck. Like, it was so bad. And then the next night, I'm standing out kind of by the door, and the owner, the guy who booked me for that show, is like, and I was just featuring, so that's not too terrible. But, I mean, he goes, "Oh, the feature act is, I watched this video. He really messes with you, so don't say anything to him. Hey, don't say anything to him." And I grab him in between customers, and I go, "Did you say that to everyone who came in yesterday?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah." And I go, "You fucked up my show." I go, "You can't tell them that." I go, "I don't rip them apart unless they're mean. I do it in a fun, we're having fun." "Oh, is that why you didn't do it?" I go, "Yeah, you fucked me."
Sabotaged me.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, at least that was easy to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah, there's been ones. I mean, you drive 17 hours, I mean, you know, like 12 hours, you show up in the middle of $10 You walk in and you're on a milk crate.
Yep.
Like, where am I performing? You're like, over there. And I'm like, that's a milk crate with a piece of carpet on it.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah, good times. What about now with you, Jason? Have you done comedy? Are you a comic?
I've never done stand-up.
Okay. Well, I
went to a mic once in Vegas with one of our former hosts, Andrew Rose, and another comic from the festival, Jimmy, and they canceled the mic. So that was like my one spot to go up, and they're like, we're not doing this. I was all prepared to do it. I have my like little notebook. I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell this joke about Ducks Unlimited.
Were you going to take notes up on stage?
Oh, of course I was. You know, like I was going to do everything against what we say to do. I was going to start with the guys, and then I was going to give it up for the MC. And then I was going to say, I'm going to wrap up on this. I was going to do all the seven things that I don't like to see on stage when I'm watching.
I could have easily talked for an hour about shows where I've
Don't limit yourself.
I'm just curious, with how did you get into the comedy industry then? What led you to being a general manager and now ultimately part of the festival?
Well, I had management experience. What's that?
Are you going to give me some credit on this?
Nah, a little bit, maybe. when I met playing poker like 15 years ago, it was before he had done the World Series of Comedy in a different incarnation in Pittsburgh a couple times, but he hadn't sort of relaunched it in its Vegas format when it first started in 2011, I guess. So we met like 2006 playing poker at the Sahara. We were playing a hand together and he was doing some goofy stuff and it was right before the break. And so we just happened to walk away from the table at the same time. I'm like, and we just started chatting and we became friends. He used to have a poker chip as his business card. And so I was working in management at the time. I had just finished a job working in minor league baseball. And then I'd just taken a job working at a curling club. But I've always been a huge comedy fan. Like when I was 11 or 12, my uncle bought me Class Clown, like from Carlin. He's like, you're mature enough to listen to this and not go and say those words at school tomorrow, you know? And so like him and the first album, Sam Kinison's first album, why am I blanking on his name? Howie Mandel's first album, Fits Like a Glove. I knew all those albums like word for word. Huge comedy fan growing up. And I was leaving one of my jobs and I just took a look online and there was a restaurant in Vancouver. That's what it was listed under Craigslist for like a general manager's position. I called them. It turned out it was a comedy club. And so I talked to Joe and like, do you think this would be a good fit for me? And then I contacted the owner and the owner was like looking for someone basically immediately. Went in and I put together
quick resume. You got a hold of me and said, do you know the owner of this club? And I said, yeah, they give us work for the festival. And I sent him an email. And I said, I got a friend in Vancouver who you should hire. So, I mean, I don't know if I, you know, you went in and got the job yourself. But, I mean, I knew him. So, I really, it was kind of cool.
And so, when I submitted my resume, I did, like, a proper cover letter that sort of explained my love for comedy. And I did a proper resume outlining my history and my background working in food and beverage and management. But in the actual body of the email, I did a joke. I did a Mitch Hedberg joke. So I was like, yeah, he's a comic. He's no longer with us, but he was very, very funny. We have a running gag in the World Series that try and sneak in Hedberg punchlines in conversation with Joe because he won't get them. And so as many Hedberg punchlines as possible before Joe clues in.
I've never seen him.
And so, and
to be honest, I hate his comedy because all I've ever heard is a bunch of fucked up friends of mine doing his shit.
So he's my favorite of all time. And so in the email, I just sort of like stock email, but then at the very bottom, I put PS, this is what the alphabet would look like if the letters Q and R were eliminated. And so Mario got back to me, he was the owner of the club, and he goes, no one's ever included a joke in like a submission for work. And so he brought me in and along with Joe's recommendation and just walking around the club, like he basically hired me on the spot and I was working the next night and dealing with international touring headliners, like basically immediately out of the gate. Vancouver is such a really cool scene. It's very similar to San Francisco in that it's like very driven by material, and people want to see the proper like premise, setup, punchline, tag, throwaway line. They're really material driven, kind of like impress mm-hmm. me with your writing style. Not so much like attitude. Toronto and Montreal a little bit more attitude driven, kind of like New York and Boston are a little bit. And so it's just like learning on like the steepest learning curve, but with a really large stable. Like we have 25 local headliners who tour across North America. So a really, really strong base of foundation for the comedy industry. And then just dealing with all those headliners helped impart a lot of their knowledge to me, you know, and we ended up developing a lot of programs at the club that were geared towards fostering the development of local comics. And so I was able to take a lot of that information and kind of like laterally transfer it to my work with the festival. I joined the festival basically when someone had to step down as part of the role for being a host, and Joe was left a little shorthanded. So I was like, I can get to these four events, you know, that it'll fit in my schedule. And so the very first one was at Laughs Unlimited in Sacramento. And it also happened to be the week that the speaker fell on Danny Fritz. And we got on TV as a result.
Yeah, you're also involved with the festival before that, right. Your initial time. But I mean, as soon as he got the job at the club, I was like, oh, great. My buddy now can come to the festival and be part of the festival and offer work. And then Mario didn't want him to come because he was so busy managing. Yeah. And, it was like, yeah. And then Jason decided to kind of move on from that. And I was like, well, how can you come to the festival? Will Mario still let you come down as a representative for the club? And so we talked to him and got that way. So that's how I was able to get Jason to just come and hang out. And then he just kept coming, and we would talk business, and he would help me a lot with a lot of things. And finally, I'm like, why don't you just join this thing?
Yeah, I sort of started on the judging side of things. I was kind of like the judge wrangler and the head judge, and that would tie into what I was doing for Mario as well, because he wanted kind of a report card of the 101. So I would just talk to Joe and like, hey, can you send me an email list of the 101? And then I'll handwrite notes and then type them up and transcribe them and send them back to Mario and be like, you'd be comfortable booking these 35, these next 35, probably ready within 6 months or 9 months kind of thing. And so that really laid a lot of the foundation for like my critical eye of watching someone from the perspective of, is this person bookable? And if they're really close to being bookable, what could they change? What are some corrective measures that they can do? And so I'm obviously heavily involved in the festival, but last year, 2020, was about creating the gig economy for everybody to try and get by. And so I also started a company called comedyfeedback.com that provides, you know, one-on-one tutoring and consultation with comedians. And so, you know, that's kind of become my niche with the festival, in addition to like trying to help Joe in like every aspect. Like the World Series of Comedy is basically a mom-pa organization, you know, like Joe and Jenny run it. And then Joe and I do a lot of like the day-to-day admin of stuff. And then we have Mike, Seth, and David, who are hosts, who will do a lot of on-site stuff at the live satellites and also do a ton of background work with us right now, leading up for prep to all these events. So it's kind of, we're kind of like the duck that's floating on the water. Like when you get to see us in person, that's when we are at our like absolute happiest to deal with that situation, because we've put in months and months of legwork. So all the work is done. And now we just get to go to the live events and really have fun and hang out with the people who have become our friends. Like you mentioned that we do daytime seminars at the main event that's meant basically to impart information to the comedians. But I did one a couple of years ago at East St. Louis at the main event. And there was 80 people who came to participate, and I do like a Q&A at the end, and I knew everyone's name, and that really blew me away. It's like, holy smokes, I've made hundreds of friends.
You tell that story because I can't remember people's names.
Another flex over here.
I mean, there's people I'm like, what's his name? No. I have a question, Jason. You've watched tons and tons of comedy. tell us one where you watch somebody die. You don't have to say who it is. It better not be me. It better not be
a good one.
It shouldn't be somebody from the festival.
I got one that's not the festival and it's live. And so we had a headliner who was a writer on a very famous comedy show and was also a national touring headliner. And I think he was a little bit spoiled by the fact that he does a lot of theater shows. And so that's more of a, like a sit down and pay attention type of audience and kind of like golf claps and applause breaks. And so the first show on Thursday, he goes out and he starts his set and he walked off stage within 25 seconds because he was upset that the crowd, that someone stage left was talking slightly. And by that time, we had already had our bouncers over to ask them to be quiet. We were already And this is a national tour and headliner who walked off stage 25 seconds into their set. So I walk backstage. I go, we can't do that. You can't do that. You want to get paid at the end of this week, right? He goes, I've never done that before. I'm like, and you're never going to do it again. So that was like me calling Mario and going like, we can never book this dude again. And one of the real benefits that we had during that moment was in Canada, the MCs are usually a local headliner. So they're usually very, very strong. And so our MC was Sonny Dollywall, and he's super, super funny. And he like handled it like a pro. He was
see who he worked with to figure this out.
He was back on stage like within seconds and like had got the crowd back on board. But then when this headliner walked back out on stage, like no one wanted to pay attention to him. This guy just quit on them. Mm-hmm. So he had to fire through another 45 minutes of dealing with that while I'm spending time with the owner talking about how we should never book this guy and then how maybe we should talk to their agent and how maybe we should never book any of the agent's clients anymore. And so it was like something I'd never seen before and thankfully had never seen since.
Hey, Dan, have you ever done any triple gigs?
I've not. I mean, I know of them, but I never did any. I've heard lots of stories, though.
I did a college, kind of a college bar. I think it was the day before Thanksgiving or after. Like, and that's usually a pretty big gig. And I get on stage, and they're just unruly audience. They're not listening to anything. It's just, and I'm kind of getting them a little bit, but it's not going smooth. But I'm ready to. I'm just like, I've been doing it quite a long time. And I'm just like, I don't give a fuck. I'm just going to plow through. And I'll just keep saying you're a bunch of fucking morons. Don't laugh every time you call a fucking idiot. And right in the middle of my set, the server walks up on stage, grabs the mic out of my hand, starts to the audience and says, if you people don't shut up and listen to him, there's no more drinks until everybody's good.
That's awesome.
He walks off and hands me the mic back. And I'm like, so then they just start yelling at me and I go, fuck this. And I walk off stage. I go, you guys don't deserve me. And I walk off stage, walk down and downstairs. I go, where's the manager? And I walk downstairs and I find the manager and he goes, looks at his watch. He's like, what are you? And I go, yeah, you should be fucking sitting in your office. You should be up there managing your crowd. Pay me and don't even tell the fucking booker about this shit or I'll explain how stupid you are. So.
Oh, comedy.
I had a post that worked for the post office come up and threaten me, like whisper in my ear something. And I go, you got to sit down. You can't be like coming up here as part of the show. So then she starts going, I'm going out to my car and get a gun. I'm going to kill you. And I go,
were you in Idaho?
That was right outside of Pittsburgh once, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
I got punched the one time in Manassas, Virginia after a show.
How did that happen?
I mean, I've
got a pretty good guess, but
I was featuring And I went up on stage and I looked at the guy in the front row and he had no teeth. And in my head, I'm going, don't say nothing, don't say nothing, don't say nothing. And then I did something. He kind of laughed and I go, hey, man, where's your teeth? And then I went on for another 20 some minutes, just ripping the shit out of him, and it got going back and forth. And finally I go, hey, you know, I'm almost done. Let's just, no, we won't do this anymore. You know, we'll have a good time. And then he's like, all right. And then I continued on because I'm an idiot. So then the show is over and I'm talking to a group of people that liked my show. And he comes up and taps me on the shoulder. No, his buddy comes up and says, my friend didn't like your show. And I go, did you like the other comic? And he's like, yeah. And I go, well, that he did more time than me. That was over half. I said, so I go, I'm just going to talk to these people who like me. And I turned away and I think they wanted to, you know, they wanted to fight and I'm just not. So then a few seconds later, I get tapped on the shoulder and I turn around and they go, we think you have a bad sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And he punched me. So then I, as I got hit, I went, oh, this is going to be a good story. I remember that's how comics think. I'm like, oh, this is great. This is material. And I turned to the people at the bar, I mean, that I was talking to, and I turned to the bartender. I said, could you call the cops? I would like to have this gentleman arrested. And he got mad that I didn't get mad. And then the cops came. It was Manassas, Virginia. That's where Lorena Bobbitt cut off John Wayne Bobbitt's dick.
Was it that night?
No, but the cop's like, sorry this had to happen to you. And I said, hey, I'm leaving with my dick. It could have been a lot worse.
That must have been really frustrating for that guy to be the butt of your jokes for 50 minutes. I wonder what that experience would be like.
Are you being a smartass?
Yeah. One time I went to one of Joe's shows.
I forgot about that.
I took 26 other people. I was coordinating a hockey tournament to Las Vegas, and I sent a text to Joe, and I'm like, hey, man, is it cool if we get some tickets to your show? And he's like, yeah, sure, no problem. So he gave us, like, comps for two hockey teams to come down and watch him perform live. Unbeknownst to me, a mutual friend of ours went to go to one of Joe's shows a week earlier, which is just a weird coincidence because he lived in Winnipeg. I live in Vancouver. What, like, why would he be there exactly the week before? And he told like this personal story about me to Joe, and Joe like started his show and about 2 minutes in just started like making inferences to the story.
Hey, has anybody ever gone on a cruise ship and paid for a cruise ship three times? You tried to get laid and didn't get laid. Is that ever anyone? Guys in this hockey team knew this story.
None of them knew it. And then I immediately
on a cruise ship three times trying to sleep with somebody that on a cruise ship. What a
And I'm sitting in the crowd and I just go like,
you work there, it's your job to like them.
Fucking Brent. It's the only person who could have told this story to Joe. Oh, God damn. And so this happened not too long after Joe and I met. So this is like 10, 12, 13 years ago. And to this day, my nickname at hockey is Cruise Ship Boy. So I was scoring a goal and they're like, nice goal, Cruise Ship. And I'm like, it's like,
that's great.
Behind me.
Well, you slept with her, right, Jason, on a third time?
Is this over? Are we done?
No, we're still. Are
you slept? Your parents paid for one of the cruises, and then you paid for two more. Cruises, I mean, they're cheap. That's the good thing about them, is they don't cost a lot of money because you live in Vancouver, and I'm pretty sure you didn't take a cruise ship right near Vancouver. You probably flew to Florida or something like that. So that's not expensive at all. And then you did it twice. And this girl's like, her picture's on the wall in the bank room for best employee of the month because she somehow swindled this ass to buy three. And she said hello to him walking by with a drink. And she's just like, oh, I think I love, she loves me. She talked to me. She must want to be with me. I'll buy two more cruises. I'll go. And she's just like, yeah, anybody else get some asshole to come on three cruise ships? No.
She's like, she's my Anna Nicole Smith.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, this has been fun. We could go on and on and on, but I don't want to keep you guys. Thank you guys so much.
My life. That was
what's
the biggest
that? That
was the biggest personal bomb of my life.
Yeah. We all have them, that's for sure.
Yeah, not three cruise ships.
Where do you want?
Where do you want people to
go? Oh, too funny. Where do you want people? Where do you want to point people to?
The World Series of
Comedy.com.
Yeah.
Perfect. That'll be in the show notes. Again, thank you guys so much for taking the time to do this. This was fun.
Oh, thanks, bud.
Thanks for having us, man. We look forward to seeing you, buddy.